welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 51, recorded on December 20th, 2018, the last episode of 2018. We're not going to do one between Christmas and New Year's. Everything is way too chaotic for that. So let's celebrate the end of the new year with a longtime friend and repeat guest host on Photo Geek Weekly. I have with me today Mike Howard. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Ready for the holidays. I think my last gifts came in today. I'm all set.
You know what? I've almost started shopping. I mean, my wife and I, we agree that there's so much stuff that we do for each other that, you know, we don't give big gifts to each other. Mm-hmm. And my wife has gotten a lot of stuff for our daughter. And for certain people in the family, it's just, you know what? I can stroll around the mall and just pick up a ton of quick little things. We're not big gift givers.
Yep.
So I'm going to take a day and visit some toy stores and visit some hardware stores and just pick up all these little fiddly things like those last minute shoppers do, and I'll be set. Because the month of December, man, it is just a whirlwind for me. I don't have time to breathe half the time. Because I'm sure you know, Mike, that I do my snowflake series.
I'm looking at one of them right now. I'm a Twitter follower of yours and a Facebook, and I see them. And I loved it. That's one of the things I love about December, seeing all the amazing photos you're going to put out.
Well, I mean, thank you. But it takes me 4 to 5 hours on average a day. Like I've been working on the one for Christmas Day for a couple of days now, here and there, an hour here, an hour there, just putting it together. It'll probably top out at around 10 to 12 hours of total time on that one.
Wow.
And if I'm doing one a day, then that's full-time work. You know, I got book orders I got to ship out. I got hundreds of emails I need to write. I got, of course, podcasts to record and everything else, and a family to spend time with, you know, as we get closer and closer to Christmas. So I'm going to be so happy after Christmas. I go one snowflake every other day, and that just opens me up and just takes all the stress away.
I'm sure a lot of your followers understand how much or have an idea of how much work you're putting into this. I'm sure a lot of them don't. Every time I see it, I do think about that. It's not the 10 seconds it took you to post that tweet. It is the hours and hours of work it took you to create that work. And every year when you start this, I'm so impressed that you're doing it again this year, because it is a commitment. It is a lot of work. I know you enjoy it, but it's still a lot of work.
Well, you know what? I save up a bunch of shows on Netflix and Amazon Prime Video. And so I binge watch those while I edit. It's like knitting a sweater after a while. It's muscle memory. So I can give some of my attention elsewhere. If it's a dialogue driven show, then I can listen to the dialogue and glance over once in a while. And that works pretty well for me. But, you know, I tried once to watch Mythbusters while I was editing a snowflake, and I ended up just watching Mythbusters for a few hours. But no, this isn't going to work. Certain shows don't coalesce properly with this editing technique.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. So what's new with you? It's been a while since we've chatted. I know you said you're getting ready for Christmas, and you know, professionally, you're kind of in the IT business, right?
Accounting and IT. So this is, I'm not in the tax sides of accounting, so this is not necessarily a busy time for us, but you know, it's just a normal busyness. So on the work side, everything is progressing as normal. On the JPEG to RAW side, we do a annual best. We do a monthly photo contest every month.
We should mention before I go any farther that you are the host of the JPEG to RAW podcast.
Yeah. You've been one of our top guests, and I think you've been on four times, something like that.
Something like that.
And I wanted to have you on in 2019. I even had a guest, a listener request. Hey, when can we have Don back? So we're definitely going to reach out to you and have you back.
So you were saying that you do something around the holidays.
Yeah, so the contest that we have every month is not like for you to win big prizes or everything. It's something to just encourage people to get out and shoot and share your photos. The December one is a little bit special in the sense that it is your best one of the year, you know, so you can pick one from any month during the year and share that. And then we typically try and give a little bit of a prize that we give out that way. So in the regular month one, we don't, but we give out some kind of prize, something like a Lightroom or the Adobe photographer plan. So you have that for a whole year. After that, you're going to have to do something on your own, but at least get you started, because there are some photographers that listen to the show that don't have something like that. Whatever, I don't know what they're using for editing, but they don't have Adobe Lightroom or Photoshop.
Right. And, you know, it's helpful to think how many possibilities we have right now compared to 5 years ago in terms of very good maturing editing suites. You know, we've got Capture One, Luminar, On One Photo Raw, which is a favorite of mine, and Affinity Photo, and so many others that are just, I'm so glad for this because, yes, I subscribe and I give Adobe way too much money every month because there's a necessity for me to use a number of their tools. I wish I was less dependent on that. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish that I could say, you know what, I'm going to walk away because I've got completely viable alternatives that will not stop my creative efficiency or workflow in any way. And I'm actively, you know, exploring them. And I was talking to somebody earlier via email who was, you know, revisiting some of these too and the different features that these guys are coming out with. It's really fun. And at the very least, if you still want to stay in the Adobe ecosystem, it's good for you too, because it puts pressure on them to innovate, absolutely, not just kind of tick along ever so slowly.
I think that their subscription model has opened an opportunity for people like Skyrim, or however you say their name, with Luminar, on One and those, and all those other alternatives. It's opened up an opportunity for those guys, because a lot of people, I hear from a lot of people, they don't want the subscription model. It seems like everybody wants you to subscribe and pay them every month, and you really want to get off of that. And I know Luminar, I don't know the date, but Luminar is working on a digital asset management feature to their software. Mm-hmm. So they'll be adding that. So if that was holding you back from using it versus Lightroom, that I think is coming. I have not used it. I don't know if it's in beta yet, but I know it's coming out.
Yeah, and On One just rolled out something very similar to a full digital asset manager. And what they had to do, actually, to make this very easy for Lightroom users to jump over, to do a direct import from your Lightroom catalog, mm-hmm, they added a bunch of functionality that they previously did not have, like split toning and you know, adding grain and things like that, so that if you had done that to any of your photographs in Lightroom, when you bring your catalog and all of your edits over to the On One Photo Raw, this is their 2019 update, then all of those edits come along with it. So
nice.
You can just one click, bring it all over and start working in a new ecosystem. And I have a preview build that improves some of their new functionality with focus stacking. And they're the only company that I know of that does focus stacking with raw data rather than having to rasterize it. And it's almost there for me. I mean, the number of images are too low. It's at 14 frames right now, but that's going to improve as they continue to flesh out the system. So 2019 is going to be a really exciting year from the software side all around. And and I'll just kind of keep my finger on the pulse of it. And I'm sure you will too.
Yeah, it's great to have choices. That's what we need, is to have choices. Because like you mentioned, even if you stick with Adobe Suite, these other choices are going to put pressure on Adobe to continue to innovate, and Adobe put pressure on them to continue to innovate.
Yeah, and we live in a photographic ecosystem right now where brands don't really matter as much as they used to. You know, if you bought into a camera system, whether it be Canon or Nikon, the two previous big giants, you'd probably stick with them for a very long time, or Pentax and lots of others. Pentax was huge in the film era. And they're still great now, but they just have less of a market share. But now you can buy any camera body, especially the new mirrorless bodies that everybody's coming out with, and grab a lens from any manufacturer, and it's either natively supported or it's adapted very, very well. And so you can kind of pick and choose. It's sort of an a la carte system now. And that's what I love, because I'm sponsored by Panasonic, and I'm really looking forward to having their full frame mirrorless cameras, and they've made great equipment. But I'll be adapting my Canon MPE 65mm super macro lens to that, because Panasonic, or really nobody else, makes one. And so you can take all these little specialty pieces and bundle them all together to create a piece of kit that is unique to your style, and just, you know, have fun with it. Be artistic and creative and have no limitations. And there's never been a better time to be a photographer.
Absolutely. Yep.
So before we get into the stories, you know, we are a few days away from Christmas, Mike. So did you have anything photographic on your Christmas wish list?
I did. You know, one of the things, as my kids got older, and before, when they were younger, I would shoot a lot of sports, their sports, their friends' sports, that kind of stuff. I got into shooting a lot of sports. That's not happening as much anymore. So I'm getting more into landscapes. And I didn't, the only filters I had were the little screw ones you would put on to the front of a lens if I wanted to use a filter. For like a circular polarizer or an ND or something like that. So I'm making a, slowly stepping into, because this could be expensive, I want to make sure I'm going to use it, slowly stepping into the Lee filter system.
Okay, so you're talking square filters then, right?
Yes.
Okay, so when you say slowly stepping in, you mean you're going to buy the apparatus to attach it to your camera,
yep,
or to your lens rather, and how many filters are you starting out with?
I'm starting out with a 3-pack of the ND grads and one separate ND filter.
Interesting that you mentioned the ND grads, because I mean I'm one to look at that solution and say, okay, well I can bracket a shot. Mm-hmm. And deal with that in post-processing rather than have to decide exactly how that comes to be in the field, especially with a non-flat horizon.
Right.
But I've heard of many photographers that have used ND grads for years. For those that don't know, an ND grad is a graduated ND filter where one end is clear and the other end is a whatever level of neutral density stopping down of light. You know, the common is 1, 3, and 5 stops, I think. I'm not sure exactly which ones
something
you're getting.
Like that, yeah.
Something like that. So in what scenarios do you think that they will be the most useful for you?
Well, you're typically going to use them whenever you're the sky is really bright and the you know, foreground or whatever that is not. So you're trying to balance that. I that's one of the things before, you know, so I'm spinning in this case, or my wife is spending, you know, so I'm spending. What is that going to be, about $600 in total? So maybe a little more than I wanted to spend, but you can definitely go wild with this and spend thousands of dollars.
Oh, easy.
Yes. So that's why I talk about I'm stepping in there. $600 doesn't sound like I'm stepping. That sounds like a big step. But it is, you know, stepping in there a little bit. I want to see how much I'm going to use it and how many use cases. Landscape photography is something that I enjoy doing. I just don't do enough of it, and I want to see how far I'm going to go with it. It's something I want to get into more.
Yeah, I bought a really inexpensive filter kit recently from K&F Concept. They make, I've had some lens adapters from them and some step-up rings, and it's one of the lower expense Chinese manufacturers that, mm-hmm, makes some good product. But there was this kit of, I think I mentioned it on a previous episode, around 18 separate filters that some of them were just in crazy colors, like red, green, and blue, and yellow, and purple.
Yeah.
And some of them were half clear, and then they graduated into those purple or whatever other colors they were. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, from a creative perspective, what if I use those as colored filters for my small flashlights, right? To start playing around with it creatively there. And yeah, I could put them on the camera. Maybe I could do some experiments where I do separate images for red, green, and blue and put them together afterwards, you know, Photoshop some channel swapping stuff going on. There's some creative options there. And it was cheap, because, mm-hmm, these are not high quality filters in terms of all of the very expensive optical coatings that you might expect from a top of the line graduated neutral density filter. And I've had some fun with it so far. You know, I've only used them in one shoot, but I want to play around with more freezing soap bubbles and snowflakes. And I have an idea. I'm not going to share it with you right now, okay, but I have an idea to make a very iconic snowflake photograph. Something that just came to mind when I started playing around with these filters. And I hope that I get the proper opportunity to explore that this winter. I think I will. And it will be as iconic as my Maple Leaf flag photograph.
Okay, awesome. So, I look forward to it. Can't wait.
We'll see what comes of that. But hey, let's get into the stories of the week. Yeah. We got some good ones here today. The first one, I figure it has some significant meaning to a lot of photographers, myself included.
Yep.
This was reported from F-Stoppers, and the title is Giant Media Conglomerate Violates Copyright, Says Federal Judge Sides with Photographer. And this is an interesting story where a photographer took a photograph of Donald Trump crashing a wedding, effectively. And so this is a photo from Jonathan Otto, a vice president at Deutsche Bank, attended the wedding of friends, and I'm reading from the article here. When President Donald Trump surprised the bride and groom by crashing their wedding, which was held at one of Trump's golf courses in Bedminster, New Jersey. So I'll paraphrase a little bit. Jonathan Otto took a photograph of just a quick cell phone snap of Trump and the bride. And then he sent that to some friends of the bride, and it ended up getting around and around, and people would share it. And on social media, and it went viral. Now, of course, Otto did not state that this was, he was just sending it for fun, mm-hmm, that you could necessarily reproduce it, and people did. But the real kicker here is that it got picked up by media outlets. And so, Mike, I'm sure you read the story here. So I want you to carry on in sort of the narrative here. What happened?
So TMZ picked it up. Several other media outlets and other things picked it up. And he then reached out to these people and said, hey, you didn't give me photo credit. You didn't give me compensation. And you need to do that. And I think a number of them settled or did something to resolve it that we didn't know in the article, but they got
rid of it. He hired an attorney.
Yeah.
And they, so that settled a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. But one of them went to court.
Yeah. One of Hearst's many companies, Esquire, said that, that the photo fell under fair use and used it in a since deleted article entitled President Trump is the Ultimate Wedding Crasher. So that's no longer online. They've taken that down because of, well, clearly this ensuing lawsuit and everything else. So we have to understand what fair use means from a legal perspective. And you have to hit a number of very specific points in fair use. Are you familiar with what they are, Mike?
I am not. I'm hoping you'll tell me.
because in Canada, it's a little bit different. We have something called fair dealing in Canada, and it's kind of under the exact same precedent, but you have to take into account a number of different factors here. So, and I'm going to paraphrase because I'm just pulling it up right now and I don't remember exactly what it means and I might miss a point or two, but effectively, number one, you can't just use it, with no context or critique or building your own narrative around that piece. So you have to give credit, of course, to the photographer or the artist of any kind. You have to be using that image for, say, if I were to be writing a textbook on artwork and I wanted to use a piece of artwork that is copyrighted, whoever created it is still in living copyright, I could reproduce that. So that I can be critiquing the work, using it as a source of an educational discussion that begins from that, and really dissecting the artwork itself, reviewing the work. Mm-hmm. And so fair use in many contexts can apply. But in this case, that did not happen. They just used
they just
the photograph.
Posted the photo.
They just posted the photograph. And so the judge, who was it, Gregory Woods, U.S. District Court judge, says in his ruling, and I love these words.
Yes.
And he specifically says stealing, which I loved. He says, stealing a copyrighted photograph to illustrate a news article without adding new understanding or meaning to the work, which is just like I described. You're not mm-hmm. critiquing it or reviewing it or using it as a source of discussion for the artwork or the photograph itself. Does not transform its purpose, regardless of whether that photograph was created for commercial or personal use. And I love that caveat because I do a lot of my images for commercial use. What if I were to take a snap of some unusual looking animal running down the street and it goes viral, like a cute three-legged dog eating an ice cream cone, whatever it happens to be, something unusual, and it gets picked up on social media and goes viral. Well, you can't use something without the permission of the owner. Unless, of course, the owner puts it into the public domain, and that's an entirely different discussion.
Or like all these snowflake photos. I could see tons of people wanting to use that in their articles.
Oh, yeah. Well, and actually, I have very recently, I have a cover shot on the cover of Nebraska Land magazine. And I talked to Renee Bloom, one of their reporters, and they did a wonderful write-up on me. And they're going to pay me for that.
Good.
So yeah. That was agreed upon from the very beginning. And I did actually put one of my snowflake photographs last year, the year before, into the public domain. Just one of them, just to see where it would end up. And I've seen people use it as album covers. I've seen people use it as profile pictures. I've seen used it to advertise events. Sure, I gave that one away just to see where it would go. And that was an experiment of mine. But I value that work. I mean, I put a lot of effort into it, and it pays the bills. It keeps the lights on here. It keeps the microphone charged. So he goes on to say, allowing a news publisher to poach an image from an individual's social media account for an article that does little more than describe the setting of the image does not promote the, quote, the progress of science and useful arts. And so, hallelujah. We have a judge that has, I don't know if this will end up in case law because it is fairly specific. I mean, if you end up in exactly the same scenario, then it could be very helpful for you. But you know what? I'm actually in kind of that scenario right now.
Really?
As of 2 days ago, and I'm not going to name names or anything, but I found a publication, a photographic publication, that is using one of my images, which they would have had to have pulled off of social media, without credit or compensation, without discussion of the image whatsoever, as the headline to a post that was published a few days ago. So again, I sent them an email. And I sent them an invoice for that usage. And as of the recording of this podcast, about 48 hours later, I have not heard back from them.
So what's your next step?
My next step is, you know what? People are busy over the holidays. I don't know exactly what's going on. I'm going to give it until the beginning of January. And then I'm going to give them a call. They didn't take the image down, so I'm not certain. The stipulation in the invoice was that they didn't have to. I mean, just pay the invoice. It's retroactive and forward-looking. You know, just pay it and we're good. And I have heard nothing. So come early January, I will give them a call and I will see if they receive the email and have a verbal conversation on the phone. And that is really stressful for me and I'm sure for them too. I mean, that I don't want to have to amp up the stress levels of anybody. I just want this to be solved quietly and politely. And everybody shakes each other's hands and say, you know, I apologize and it's settled. But in this scenario, I did not register the copyright to this image.
I was going
to
ask you that, if that's the same as it is here in the States, if it's that way in Canada.
Yeah, well, if the infringement is in Canada, you don't need to on the same stipulations as you do in the United States. Right. So we have a stronger ability to pursue things without a copyright registration. But this was an image that was taken earlier this year. And I was planning at the end of 2019, because I'm doing like an image a day right now, that or 2018 rather. As soon as I get into 2019, I'll take the lump of everything that I did in 2018 and register the copyright together, all as one single unit. And this happens like a few days before the end of the year. So I haven't gotten there yet. And that's frustrating. Maybe I should be a little bit more proactive on that. But it's frustrating when you see that happen as an artist, you know, as somebody that, whether it's personal or commercial, people misappropriating your work is never a good feeling.
Yeah. So I don't have near the body of work in quantity or quality that you do. But I one time walked into my local Walmart. And you know how they have the little photo section where you can get your photos developed or yep. printed or whatever back there. I walked back there and on the shelf was a big print of mine just sitting there. And I was like, huh? Why would it be in my local Walmart? Well, because it was of a local structure. It was our city town center. I had taken that. It was mine. You let the city use it, and they've used it for some stuff. And the copyright to them was for their use only. But they put it on their Facebook page. I think they put it on their web page and use it some other places. And I walk in, and there it is. It's sitting there. So I asked them, I said, what is happening with this photo? Why is this photo sitting here? After I complimented on how awesome the photo was. And they said, oh, it's some customer is getting it printed. And, you know, they didn't come pick it up. So it's just sitting here waiting and for that. So at that point, I wasn't quite as upset because I'm not going to pursue every individual that does it. In your case, and both of them are copyright infringements, but especially, it seems to me, especially egregious when you have a for-profit business who is stealing other people's work. They didn't take it. They didn't pay for it. They know it's not their stuff.
And they didn't even ask. Yeah. Sometimes people ask to use an image for free, and I'll say no. I mean, let's be fair about this. If you want to use the image, it has value to you. So let's agree upon what that value is in dollars. And if people just walk away from me, the sad truth is that they're going to go to somebody else that might have something similar, maybe not quite as good, maybe something a little bit different. and they might be willing to let it be used for free. And I don't think anybody should. So, but you know, talking about social media, this is a good segue into our next story here, because as photographers, we are on social media. That's how we share our work for the most part. And there are so many different venues. I'm on six or seven of them right now, including the much maligned Google Plus, which will be shutting down earlier than expected. I'm going to finish this final Snowflake series and then it's going to be done at that point. This story is about Facebook. And so this from Petapixel is reporting that a Facebook bug exposed unpublished photos for up to 6.8 million users. So, Mike, this is kind of interesting because you are in IT, and I'm sure that you you get a bunch of, okay, well, there's a security update for this, that, and the other thing, and you have to, you know, light a fire under people yourself and anybody working with you to make sure that security updates are in place as quickly as possible. And you might do some routines to make sure that everybody is following the best practices and not clicking on suspicious links, et cetera, et cetera. But this, you wouldn't have had any control over.
Yeah.
This is on Facebook. And so, the article says for 12 days between September 13th and September 25th of this year, which red flag right now, this is mid-December. Why are we hearing about this now rather than shortly after it happened? And that bugs me a little bit. But between those dates, some of the photo apps may have had a much broader range of access than the users or Facebook had granted. So apps to Facebook, you can have apps that will have access to your Facebook account for a variety of different things, posting things or seeing your contacts, you know, using Facebook Messenger in a different app, et cetera.
It was like 1,500 apps.
Yeah, there's a lot of apps.
There was a ton.
So instead of only being able to see photos that have been publicly shared on a user's timeline, those apps could see even photos that were uploaded to Facebook but not yet published. And so, I mean, the example would be if I'm about to publish something, but I haven't actually, you know, hit the OK button, Facebook will store that image on their servers for a number of days. I think 3 days, they said, so that you could actually upload that officially. But what if you have remorse about what you're about to post and you decide, you know what, it's better that I don't do that? Well, these apps would have had access to that, which could have been fairly sensitive material. It could have been something that you were about to promote, like a big deal, a new announcement that you're just sitting there and waiting on, and now somebody could spill the beans before you. Maybe it's not as big of a deal, but the fact that 1,500 apps could have had access to photos that were either listed as private or not completely finished uploading, that's kind of scary.
It is scary. And every time I hear the initial release of any company saying this many customers or this many things happened, it seems like there's always a follow-up with a new number that is much bigger than the other one. But even if this 6.8 million users is the final number or close to it, I got to imagine, like me and probably almost everybody who uses Facebook, had no idea that anybody could ever see, other than maybe Facebook if they cared to, photos that I didn't actually post.
Yeah. Well, but here's the valuable thing about the story, the silver lining, we'll call it. The first sentence of this article says, Facebook revealed today, and this article was published on December 14th, that it discovered a software bug, Facebook themselves discovered the software bug. Now that's valuable because that means that that was an internal committee or, you know, SWAT team of programmers that discovered this particular bug. So, that means that it wasn't a third party that had discovered this and was exploiting it for that time period, or that had sold the bug bounty back to Facebook, as a lot of people will do. If you uncover something and you report it to the software vendor, there's often these bounty programs that will help you, you know, make a little bit of money off of your discovery in a proper way rather than exploiting it on the dark areas of the internet. So it's kind of concerning because that leads into a related story about Facebook as well. And this, it's reported in like not just photo news media, but The Guardian. I pulled up an article that said Facebook shared private user messages with Netflix and Spotify amongst other people.
I think this
one's worse because this is not an accident.
Yes.
This is deliberate, right? And so effectively they said, okay, well, you guys, you know, it says the social media giant granted major companies far more exceptions to its privacy policies than previously known, continuing to say that making user data available through loopholes to companies including Amazon, Microsoft, and Sony. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, Netflix and Spotify, and the Royal Bank of Canada,
they gave them read, write, and delete of users' private messages.
Yeah, so they could. I mean, it's funny because
write, and delete. That's
yes. Further in the article, it says Netflix replied to the story in a tweet saying that it never asked for or accessed anyone's private messages, were not the type to slide into your DMs. So yeah, what is Facebook even doing here? It's like me going into a liquor store and saying, you know what, guy, give me the good stuff. And he pulls out a brick of cocaine. Yeah. Like, no, I'm looking for a decent scotch here.
Yeah, or a good wine or something, not coke.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to touch that stuff. So really, I mean, Facebook has said that they've dialed this back. These kinds of arrangements are being phased out, or they're no longer something that is moving forward. But it makes me worry that the end user had absolutely no knowledge of these kinds of backroom arrangements. But yet, Facebook is still a very active, one of the biggest social media platforms. And of course, Facebook owns Instagram, which are two of the biggest platforms that I'm on right now. And the interaction on those platforms is great. It's a great way for mm-hmm. me to share my work and to sell workshops and prints. And I've done a lot of that. And I've got a very engaged audience on both of those platforms owned by Facebook. So at what point, Mike, would you walk away from the potential viable advantages to your business when you see news like this?
I don't know. It is a hard thing to do because JPEG to RAW, which is not a business, I do that for fun. You know, that's where our community is. But I also know a lot of photographers who built up a large following on their Facebook page, and they use that to drive their business as one of the things to drive their business. And that's been in decline for a while. So they were already questioning. But the problem for them is, where do I go from here? You know, what do I do? But I have seen a decline ourselves in the Facebook activity within our group. And I know specifically of some people who've totally left it because of these things. I would like to mention one of the things that Facebook says in this article is none of these partnerships or features gave companies access to information without people's permission. Now, I will say that if you polled, I don't have any evidence, I'm just basing this on my thought. If you polled 100 Facebook users and said, Did you give Facebook permission to share, to write, read, and delete your private messages on Facebook? I would imagine that 99 or 100 of them would say, absolutely not.
Yeah, I would say 100% unequivocally would have said, no way, I wouldn't have agreed to that. But, you know, periodically, these companies will update their terms of service or their mm-hmm. end user license agreement or whatever you want to call it. And nobody reads those yes. ever. I mean, it's like 100 page of legalese. So in there, it's like, oh, we've updated yours. Maybe it's not for everybody, but maybe for a specific percentage of users or something. And they've hidden a line in there that said that this is going to happen. Not a single user is ever going to uncover that. And if they did this in a non-universal way, so that it wasn't every user, then the watchdogs that might go and look for changes in this might have been unaware of it as well. Mm-hmm. So there's tons of sneaky ways for them to say, yeah, we told you about it. You know, it's bullet point number 77, section 4E of the end user license agreement updated on, you know, January 17th of 2016. You didn't read that?
Come on, everybody read that.
But exactly.
And that was my point, is that if those 100 people, if I had my private messages read and Facebook said, you agreed to that, I would say, if I have no idea. I don't ever remember seeing being asked for that. I did not specifically want to give that access. And I wonder if at some point there isn't some pushback on those long agreements like you just mentioned, that some court doesn't say, look, you can't fool your customers or the public by writing this long thing that we all know none of them read. And there's a balance here. You can't, you know, customers just can't claim, you know, I didn't know anything and violate all the rules. But I think that the balance has shifted too far the other way. And they write these long things knowing we won't read it, but it later provides them cover.
But there is some value to some of the length that they go into, because when one of these platforms, and I'm going to use Instagram as an example here, and it kind of ties back into the previous story as well. If you post something on Instagram, they have the ability to republish that on different platforms through their API. They have a worldwide license to redistribute it anywhere that they want. And so that means that a news article somewhere can embed your Instagram photo. So if Jonathan Otto from the first photo from the first story posted that photograph to Instagram, and then Esquire embedded that Instagram post in their page, there's nothing he could have done about that mm-hmm. because he agreed to the terms of Instagram, which completely allow that to happen. And you know, to his benefit though. It would funnel a ton of interest back to him on his Instagram account, because you click on that, you go directly to his account and his followership would be improved for that. And that happened to me recently. The Russian website mail.ru, which is huge in Russia, published a story of my snowflake photographs on Instagram. And so in that case, a lot of Russian people started following me on Instagram. I was so confused. You know, I eventually reached out to one of these people that was following me that had, instead of Cyrillic letters, it was written in English. So I knew that they would speak English. And he said, yeah, you know, you were featured on mail.ru and it was a great article. And I followed you from there. And this is some brewmaster in Russia. So cool. Thank you for following me. Yeah. But I ended up with 1,500 new followers from that one article posted in a foreign language news outlet. And so that pushed me over 10,000 followers on Instagram. Woohoo!
Ooh, yeah.
And they were completely allowed to do that. There's no issues with that whatsoever. And I don't mind that, because all of their audience is directed directly back to my own platform. And that audience can, you know, at least some of it, trickle down to become my audience as well. So there's value in the terms as they lay them out, because they need to go into all of the minutiae of how they disseminate your content and what they're allowed to do. Because if they didn't, they wouldn't be allowed to do that, right?
Right. True. I just kind of think the balance is shifted a little too far the other way.
Exactly. And you know, I've complained that it is so overarching, because technically Facebook or Instagram or any social media platform could take any of my photographs and print it on their Christmas cards and mail them out that way. And that's covered by these terms, because there's no clause that limits the context of the usage, right? And I would love for these companies to say, yeah, you know, we will share it and we'll share the post in the context or an approximate context of the way that it was originally shared, rather than saying, hey, you know, XYZ social media platform wants to advertise themselves on billboards and they could use my images on that billboard without any compensation. And the way things are written right now, they could do that.
Wow.
There's nothing stating that they couldn't. Now, they wouldn't, they would win in the court of law, but they would lose so poorly in the court of public opinion that I don't think anybody would do that. That brings me to the next story. The court of public opinion is coming down on not Meyer Optik Gorelitz. That company is now defunct. If you're a longtime listener of this podcast, you know we've talked about this a number of times. NetSE, the parent company of Meyer Optik and a number of other brands, Emil Busch AG, Rathenau, Aprimogena, and others. They had basically bought up all of these old defunct camera names and started producing new products under those brands. They went bankrupt recently. But one of their creditors, OPC Optics, also known as Precision Components Europe GmbH, has acquired the trademark rights to the Meyer Optik Gorelitz name at the insolvency procedure of NetSE in Koblenz. So OPC Optics, they manufacture prototypes and small series of lenses, and they're planning to use the brand as a vehicle to enter into consumer markets. It's a space that they have not been in. And why not use this wonderfully untarnished brand to jump into the marketplace? Well, they probably got it for free, because they were owed significant money from Meyer Optik, and that's one of the ways that they were going to be paid. But this is the real frustration point, especially if you're launching a new brand that already has tarnish on it. In a press release, and this is being reported by DP Review, The company also says that unfortunately it can't take on any of NetSE's obligations, which means if NetSE hadn't delivered your crowdfunded lens, OPC won't do so either. Shooting yourselves in both feet here so you can't take a step forward? That's what it sounds like to me, Mike.
Yeah, I think the unfortunate thing is whenever a bankruptcy goes through like that, it really, there's no winners. You know, everybody seems to suffer. In this case, I don't know the specifics to this bankruptcy, but if they got the copyright, the name as part of the deal, as part of a payment, they're probably now looking as a way to monetize that. So if they got that in form of this company owes me money and you're going to give me your name and then I'm going to monetize it, they don't want to have to take on any of the prior obligations with it because that lowers the monetization of that name. So they're going to try and start fresh.
By that very virtue, you can't start fresh, yes, because you've got all of these prior obligations that you're not going to do good on, which are for exactly the clientele that you are going to try and court.
And that's the problem here. Yeah. You're going to try and sell to the people that are already mad because the person with this name before didn't live up to it. And you're going to use that name and try and sell them something new, but not deliver what they were owed before. Yeah. It's bad taste.
I wonder what kind of warehouse of lenses that were completed in production but not yet delivered because they didn't meet their quotas for shipping them out, or that were from previous campaigns that were just sitting there that weren't going to be sold because the price tag, if you don't get it on crowdfunding, is like double. Mm. And how many people are actually going to buy that lens? I think that was a fundamental problem with their marketing strategy there. But if OPC Optics now owns the Meyer Optical Orlitz name, then presumably any products bearing that name would be encumbered by trademark issues if anybody else has possession of them. So that would be useless to anybody else. Mm-hmm. Thereby, it's a guess, because again, I don't have any inside knowledge of these bankruptcy proceedings, and I couldn't find them published anywhere specifically. But it means that it would only ever be valuable to OPC Optics. So if I can assume that they also have the inventory, the completed product inventory and any uncompleted inventory left over from Meyer Optic, and then they try to resell them to people.
They could sell them to the same person who already bought it through crowdfunding. That's just so awful.
It's maddening. So this is a real shame because companies like Meyer Optic Orlitz, while they might have been mismanaged and they did not meet a happy ending, I own one of their lenses. I've said before, I have one of their Trio Plan 100, which I did pay full retail price after crowdfunding for. Tack sharp when you stop it down. It's got crazy soap bubble bokeh when it's wide open. And I'll be using that on cameras for many years to come. From an optical formula that I think was originally developed in 1916, that of course has been refined with better glass and coatings, etc. But I look at that lens and I think, you know, what could this have been? You know, if this was done right and priced accordingly, it could have been a huge success. Now, I'm going to be following this because I like that kind of vintage lens for certain effects and certain feels. Like we mentioned at the beginning, branding is less important for some things because nobody else had a lens that did exactly that. There's a lot of vintage lenses that can give you soap bubble bokeh, and I own a bunch of them too from a variety of different brands because they had this unique feature. So they've got a dig themselves out of a hole here. Mm-hmm. And they didn't necessarily put themselves into the hole, but they bought that hole and jumped right in.
They did. So I've been involved in one bankruptcy, not the company I was working for, but I worked in that. And I can tell you, there's just the feeling that you have, from my standpoint, at least with my involvement in it, is everybody ends up a loser. Except there are a couple of winners and you hate those people.
I had one company.
The lawyers.
Of course. Yeah. I had a copyright infringement case that was not paid out and the company went bankrupt. And I was listed as one of the creditors for the amount that was demanded for that copyright infringement settlement. And I got notification from their bankruptcy lawyers and I filled out the paperwork and everything. It was like 2 years ago. I'm not going to see a penny. If I were to get 10% of what that settlement was to be claimed, I would be surprised. I'm just getting nothing. It's done. It's gone. And so I'm a loser there too.
And they prioritize the you know, the debt. So, you know, an employee would probably come before your debt. But there's other people who come before the employees, you know, so the employees are not the top people, at least here in the United States, when you're looking at debtors for a company like that. And by the time you get down to some of those, the lower people on the list, there's not a lot left, if anything.
That's depressing.
It is.
Mike, that's it's very sad. So let's change our mood around here with our final story.
I love this story.
Because this one, I just, if you're having a bad day, bookmark this video and just watch it again, because I'm sure it will brighten your day. An article from Petapixel that says, ex-NASA engineer builds a glitter fart camera trap for package thieves. Oh, that the title, a glitter fart camera trap, just makes me so happy. So this NASA engineer, Mark Rober, if I'm pronouncing his name right. And by the way, he does some other amazingly fun videos on YouTube. I've subscribed to so few YouTube channels. I subscribe to him after watching this video. It's that good. You have to watch this video. Maybe even stop listening to this podcast right now. Pick up our discussion afterwards. This video is worth watching. You can find the link in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com. Rober, the article says that he worked at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory for 9 years. His work is currently being driven around by the Curiosity rover on Mars. That's a very impressive. Very impressive. But he had an issue where he saw somebody walk up to his front step, because he had a front door camera, security camera, and saw them just steal a parcel off of his step. He only discovered that after he saw the notice that it was delivered, but he never got it. And so he investigated and found that somebody just walked up and stole it.
It's awful. So that is just awful.
This is a pervasive thing. I mean, we've got this little vestibule entranceway. It's harder to see if somebody leaves a package there on our front door. But I've been thinking about what if this happens to me too? Because Amazon and so many other people, you know, if there's no signature required, they just leave it at your front door.
Yep.
And anybody you can just walk by the neighborhood and just look for packages, especially this time of the year, and steal somebody's Christmas present.
Watching this video, we haven't got into what he does, but watching this video, I'd almost want to move. How often people are stealing his stuff? It's just insane.
Well, but I don't think it's his location. I think that this is everywhere across North America.
Right. But in this one video, I think a lot of
Porch is very easy to see from the sidewalk, and people just spot the parcel and walk right up. I mean, you could easily, you know, take the little picket fence on your porch and put something a little bit more solid there to stop people from seeing it all the way. But
tell us
Mark's
what the package
solution
is.
Here. So Mark's solution here is much more interesting. So he wanted to design something that would deter these porch pirates from doing this ever again, or really seriously rethink their actions. So what it does is, when you open up the top of it, there is a spinner inside that creates enough centripetal force to spin out the finest particulate of glitter in something like larger than the size of a baseball. And just spreads it everywhere around when you take the lid off of this thing. It also has within it a little aerosol can that has the distinct stink of farts. And one of these sprays from this can will clear out a room. And he makes sure that this thing sprays five times.
Five times but every 30 seconds or something like that.
Five times every 30 seconds until you put the lid back on the thing. But what fun is that if you can't see the reactions of people? So he's built into this 4 separate phones, all on an angle, all with fairly wide angle lenses, and the outside of the box can capture things even when the box lid is closed. And the trick, I mean, the engineering challenges begin immediately, because how do you make sure that this thing stays charged? What if it's sitting on your porch for, you know, 2-3 days? So he's got a special motion sensor inside that detects when the package is being moved, and it wakes everything up inside. And then there's a GPS that lets him track where the package is, which is triggered as soon as it leaves his home, the radius of his home property. And so he can start tracking where the package is going. And even if he can't recover the package, every one of the phones is equipped with a 4G SIM card to upload the video to the cloud immediately. So if he doesn't get it back for whatever reason, he still has the footage that is recovered. And he went so far as to even design a charging port in the bottom so he doesn't have to disassemble anything if nobody steals it that day. He made it look like a HomePod, which might be a desirable thing. And just the level of detail he goes into this, because he was inspired by the Home Alone movies and the inventiveness of Mr. Kevin McAllister. And yep. He put a shipping label on the box itself. And he says it is from Kevin McAllister.
And used the address.
He went so far as to look up the house that they used in the movie to find that actual address as an Easter egg and put that as that. And the recipients is his friends, Harry and Marv. And so if anybody had actually read the label, something might have been suspicious. Of course, we're not dealing with very high intellect individuals for this. The best part of the video, and the reason why you have to watch this, is the results that he received from people opening this device in their home and in their cars. It is just, I was on the floor laughing. I could watch an entire YouTube series of people just opening this package for 10 hours straight and not get tired of it. It is just glorious.
And he's able to recover it quite often because people, when they're driving the car and boom, you know, the glitter goes everywhere and they're, what is going on?
And well, then the fart stink makes them. Yeah.
Yeah. Then the fart start and they go again. And then people are like, get that thing out of here. And he just throws it out the window. And then he's able to recover it because of the GPS. So he's able to recover it multiple times.
Yeah. But I mean, if I were him, I would sell this. If this was a sellable product, I would buy one. Mm-hmm. Even if it's unlikely anybody would steal something from my front porch, I just want to try.
I'd want to find a friend who would, it would be stolen from their house. Because yes, this is hilarious, this video that he does it. And it, because of the way he has his phones in there, you can see it from every angle. So you get a good view there. I'm not sure which ones are my favorite, the ones in the cars or the one at home, because...
I think the last one was my favorite, where, and I'm going to paraphrase, but the glitter explodes in this guy's car. And the guy, I can't remember if he utters a profanity.
They all do, seems like.
But he says something like, what the heck is my girlfriend going to think when she sees this? She'll say, who the heck did you have in this car?
And if you've ever tried to vacuum glitter... Especially this very, very fine glitter.
This isn't
glitter.
Like the thick confetti glitter. This is the finest, almost like sand grain particulate glitter. If this explodes anywhere where it's going to be forever in the crevices yes. of that room.
You
or
will
that car.
Never get rid of all that glitter.
So this is a really fun use of photography. Any engineer or street photographer would absolutely love this. But I think just every human being that is an honest person would love to see this kind of revenge. And the number of times, I was actually surprised though, the number of times that this package was stolen off of his porch was surprising.
That's what I was talking about. I almost want to move. I know this happens everywhere, but it happened for him quite often.
Yeah. So this is a must watch video. It's about 11 minutes long, and it's worth every minute of that. So, you know, it's a fun way to end off the stories for the week on a high note for the year. And so there we have it. I'm glad you got a kick out of that too, Mike.
I did. I love that video. Even when told my son, you got to watch this video, and he said, I've already seen it.
Oh, awesome. Okay, so let's get into our picks of the week for the day, for the weekend. I've got one that to me was I didn't even know it was out there until I started to search for it, because I recently about a year ago switched from shooting Canon to shooting Lumix, and my Windows operating system would automatically recognize any CRT CR2 files from my Canon RAW files, that's their file format, and show me a thumbnail of them in Windows Explorer. Mm-hmm. It was very helpful, especially if I'm looking for a particular RAW file outside of Lightroom or Bridge. It was easy for me to find them very quickly and drag them to some project that I might be working on. But the Panasonic Lumix RAW files were not supported properly by Windows. And I think Panasonic had a RAW file support, but it hadn't been updated in almost a decade, like 8 or 9 years ago. And so there was no thumbnails available, and there was no updates from Microsoft or from Panasonic for this, for whatever reason. And I'm not sure what the reasons might be, but I found a third party. It's called Fast Picture Viewer Codec Pack. And so it's fastpictureviewer.com. They have a piece of software, but if you just want the codec so that it shows up properly in Windows Explorer, it's fastpictureviewer.com/codecs. And for $9.99 US, you get, and they updated it fairly recently, April of 2017. Now, the cameras that I'm using came out well after that, but they're still supported by the software. It's not camera specific. I think it's file format specific. So long as it can read the embedded JPEG file inside the RAW file, it'll give you a thumbnail. This codec pack, and I'm not sure if it'll work with the new Canon CR3 files or anything, because I haven't had any of those to test, but with a $10 expense, all of my RAW files that I've been shooting in the last year now magically have thumbnails. So there you go. This was a very important time-saving thing for me. And for $10, I think it's worthwhile.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's anything that can help your workflow and speed things up for $10. That's pretty simple. And just being able to look at them there in File Explorer is awesome. I did look at that. I don't, in my use case, I don't have a use case for it right now. But I looked at it, and there's even instructions to install it on Windows XP if you're still running that.
Oh, really? Of course, Windows XP would never have support for viewing the RAW files as thumbnails. And so
I'm kind of joking. You shouldn't be running Windows XP anymore.
Well, no, you shouldn't. But I mean, some people, they're stuck on it for whatever reason. You can't buy a new computer, and you don't want to go to Vista or 8, and maybe Windows 10 is not compatible anymore. So, there are still people using it. Yeah. So, I wouldn't recommend doing that. But hey, if you have no choice, then there you go. Spend $10, and you can see your RAW files. Yeah. Good luck processing them on Windows XP, but at least you could see them.
Yes.
All right, Mike, I know you've got some interesting picks. One, I think, is a quicker one. One's a little bit of a longer one, and I want you to get through both of them.
Okay. So for me, you this is an audio podcast, so you can't see me, but I wear glasses. And when I go to shoot, shooting with glasses, I'm used to it. It's not as big of a deal anymore, but I've always wished I could shoot without glasses. And I know that there's a little diopter adjustment on there, but if your vision is like mine, and you turn the diopter to the max setting and you still can't see clearly through it, the diopter adjusting really is just for making it sharper when you're wearing your glasses. So I have a Nikon. You shoot mainly with my Nikon D500. And these things exist for more than just Nikon, but the one I bought is Nikon. It's a diopter adjustment, and you use it to change out your little viewfinder. You just screw that off, screw this new one on. I got the -3, and now I can view through my camera without using my glasses. I still got to adjust the diopter to make it, right for my vision. But I can now take photos without having to wear my glasses.
And just don't give that camera to anybody else with normal vision.
True, right. If I hand it to somebody else. But I will tell you that even when I'm shooting with my glasses, I have moved the diopter to fit to my glasses. So if you picked it up, you would go, unless you had vision that was close to me with my glasses on, it would have been off for you too. So you're going to have to make some adjustments. Yeah.
And it's not expensive. I'm looking at the Amazon
$18
article
$18 or so.
$17.95 plus shipping. So yeah. If you want to make a better shooting experience for yourself because your vision is less than perfect and you can't quite sway it far enough, because I think the built-in diopter doesn't go to a -3 setting, and that's why you have to go this far, right?
Right. And for me, so with this on there, I can wear my glasses and turn it away from the max setting and have it fit for my glasses, or take my glasses off and turn the diopter. So now with this on there, I can wear or not wear my glasses, and it works. Great.
Fantastic.
Great. I love that.
A simple, nice little add-on right from Nikon for a couple of bucks and improves your camera. That's a great pick, especially, it's probably a little bit late at this point for stocking stuffers, but you can always present that as a nice little after the fact, say, here's your bonus Christmas gift. Maybe you celebrate the Eastern Orthodox Christmas is January 7th or 8th. Maybe pretend it's a Christmas gift then, and you're good to go.
Yeah, something like that. So my second pick, this is a very popular item. I bought it. We went up to Alaska in the summer, and I wanted to take photos and videos with my phone, and I wanted to have something that would be a gimbal. So I got the DJI Osmo Mobile 2. It's about $120, and it is not going to get rid of all camera shake, but it is amazing the difference between with and without. There,
and this is specifically designed for smartphones, right?
It is for your phone. So it'll fit. I have a Galaxy S9 Plus. My wife has the Note. It's a pretty large phone, and it fits in there. I do have to take the case off just because of the way I want it to sit in there, but it fits, you know, fairly well with those larger phones. I have some video of me hanging. I'm basically hanging off the side of a train as we're going through Alaska, and you know the train is rocking back and forth, and I'm holding this. I do have a hand strap on just in case I dropped it. I bought that separately, and I'm taking video as we go through. And when I watched it later on, it is just amazing how smooth it is. You'd never know I was on a train like that. So it's not magic. It's not going to get rid of everything, but it is a huge difference between with and without.
And at that price point, I'm surprised that this technology can be sold for $120. And DJI is still making a profit on that, especially knowing how much Amazon does take a cut of that too. So the fact that it's so inexpensive makes me lust after it, because something like this, you know, for a cell phone, of course, it's going to be a lighter and more, you know, light duty system mm-hmm. than compared to something for a camera. But $120, I almost want to just buy one now, right now, just looking at it. It's a nice device. It looks really, you know, lots of polish. How long does the battery life last?
The battery is like 18 hours. So I would
really,
yeah. And you can use it to help power your phone. Of course, it'll drain the battery quite a bit faster, but you know, each day when I got done shooting, of course, my battery, my phone was spent way before the end of the day. This thing, I would charge it at the end of the day, but it still had lots of charge left.
Very cool. Very cool. And when did this come out? This was recent, this year, right?
Sometime earlier in this year, yeah. Because when I bought it for our trip in June, it wasn't that old, if I remember right. So it has been out there for a while now, but it's still fairly new. It, you know, unlike the new one they just released, I can't remember the name of it, that has a camera built into it. This one, you put your cell phone into it and use it that way. You may be able to fit a GoPro in it. I've never tried that, but it does fit the phones.
Yeah. I mean, you could, if you're really creative with a small point and shoot camera and some gaffer's tape, I'm sure you could make something else work with that as right. well. But it does have that very, iconic cell phone clamp that you would find for like a cell phone holder for a car or anything else similar right. to that. Right?
And I think if you say, well, my phone has some image stabilization built into it, they're not that good. You know, some of it is digital stabilization, and you can definitely tell the wonkiness of the video when it does that. I mean, you want to turn that off when you stick it into the Osmo, but it is a world of difference between the two.
Awesome. The DJI Osmo Mobile 2. And that might just be on my wish list here. So thanks for that, Mike. You've sure. you've made me maybe spend some money.
Good.
So where can people find you? The JPEG to RAW podcast, I think, is a good go-to spot. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that, maybe some recent episodes you've done.
JPEGToRAW.com is where you can find us. Tim Kemperly is my co-host. He's been with me for over 7 years now. We're done with 2018. We did our last show two nights ago. And heading into the holidays, we'll take a couple weeks off, then we'll start up again the next year. We do a mix. We do have great guests like Don on the show. And we also, Tim and I, cover some, you know, recent news, camera photography news, and go over some tips too. The theory of JPEG to RAW was not how to convert JPEGs into RAW, but it was the journey a beginning photographer takes, which we're representing with JPEG, to a more experienced photographer, which we're saying is RAW. So that journey. And we just love talking and meeting new photographers.
And that journey, I think, every photographer has to go down that journey. And I don't think that journey ever has an end,
no.
right? It's not like you can say, oh, I'm JPEG today and I'm RAW tomorrow. You know, it's from where you start to where you finish. And with most of us as photographers, unless you completely throw your hands in the air and say, I'm giving up photography entirely, I'm not owning a camera anymore, the time that you stop is the day that you die, mm-hmm. Really, because it does get into our blood as photographers. And it's not something that you ever retire from. It's not something that you ever give up as a passion. And I know that from my own dad, who was a photographer up until his final days, and just loved photographing everything that he could. And that to me, really embodies what JPEG to RAW is all about. And I've listened to some of your episodes that show that same kind of passion, where people are just so enthralled, not with their own work necessarily, but with the industry and what other artists are doing and how that can inspire them and how that how they push forward and the winding road that every photographer takes that's unique to them.
Yep. And we now have a spinoff show, which is the JPEG to RAW photo review show. And the purpose, the theory behind that was to take those images that people submitted to the contest and to give some feedback on, here's the, I'm cautious to call it a critique, because the way the feedback is done is not in a teardown type of way. It's in a uplifting way, you know, to give feedback on how this image could be better or what we like about the image or something like that. And whether it's your image or whether it's not your image, listening to some of the feedback, it's not all from me, because that my co-host knows a lot more about photography than me, A.D. Wheeler. So he gives a lot of feedback and discusses this stuff. And it's, I think it's it, for the people who have been engaged with it, it has really helped them out and they've come a long way. I love seeing progression. I love seeing these photographers who were good to begin with, and now the work they're putting out is just amazing. And if we play any small role in that, even if it's just watching them do it, I enjoy it.
Well, if you ever want a guest host on that podcast as well, I'm open to it. I love giving, and I'll call it a critique, because a critique has to be constructive. Mm-hmm. It can't just bring somebody down. It has to give them building blocks to make sure that the next time that they go out with their camera, there's other thoughts rattling around in their head to say, well, why don't I try this or that? Or, you know, let's experiment in this way. I've never tried this before. It was suggested. Or even in post-processing, you know, you get that image home and saying, you know what? I don't need to constrain it to the 3x2 or 4x3 aspect ratio. I don't need to make it Instagram square. I can choose something arbitrary to the taste of that particular image. And even that as a point of just inspiration to a photographer that isn't used to experimenting. Yeah. Is really valuable. So lots of stuff at every step of the way. JPEG to RAW. And what's your new spinoff called?
JPEG to RAW Photo Review.
Photo review. Perfect. Yeah. Well, Mike, thank you so much for being on again, winding down the 2018 year. It's been a great year. It has been the defining year for this podcast because we only started in November of 2017. So this year we have really come to who we are and what we mean as a podcast. And if you're listening to this, if you're still on the line, thank you so much for being with us this year. You can find the show notes at photogeekweekly.com. You can find my website at donkom.ca, donkom.ca. Either way, you'll find contacts where you can get in touch with me. You can suggest stories. You can suggest guest hosts. You can just write in with your comments or write them onto the website itself. I always love to hear from the people that listen. And if you enjoy this, please write a review on iTunes or wherever else you listen to this, where you could plug in a positive commentary, because that helps more people to discover this podcast, grows the audience, and that gives us more possibilities in the future. Thank you so much, everybody, for 2018. We're signing off until next year. And with that said, it's time to get out and shoot.